Welcome to the Bill Kelly Podcast. I'm Bill Kelly. What effect does disinformation have on our society when it comes from notable Canadians? We'll talk about that. Brian J. Karam, political analyst for CNN and a White House reporter, will join us to talk about Donald Trump's latest lawsuits. And one in six Ontario households is struggling with food insecurity. Is it going to get worse before it gets better? It's all coming up in the Bill Kelly Podcast, and it starts now.
Today on the Bill Kelly Show on 900 CHML.
We want to talk about misinformation on social media, which is reaching epidemic proportions. U.S. researchers now say the TikTok search results are just riddled with misinformation. Mike Gracia has details.
A research report published Wednesday says searches on the TikTok platform regularly steer users to misleading information. According to NewsGuard, in nearly one in five searches on TikTok, the platform suggested videos that contained misinformation. For example, researchers say they found misinformation in searches for videos about mRNA vaccine, the 2020 election, the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, climate change, and Russia's invasion of Ukraine. TikTok, which is owned by Chinese company ByteDance, trails only Google among the most popular domains in the world, according to online performance and security company Cloudflare. In a statement, TikTok said its community guidelines prohibit harmful misinformation. I'm Mike Gracia.
Well, whether or not they promote it or prohibit it, doesn't much matter. It's there, and it's getting worse, I think. Let's ask our next guest about this. Marcus Kolga is a director of disinfowatch.org and also a senior fellow with the McDonald Laurier Institute. Marcus, pleasure to have you back on the program. Thanks for the time today.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
How rampant is this, and how much of a problem is it right now?
It's a huge problem. It's a problem that really started, the seeds were first sown in, around 2014, 2015, certainly with the rise of Donald Trump, who is well known for having trafficked in misinformation and conspiracies. It's really grown since then. And you're absolutely right. This is a huge problem. It is really a serious and fundamental threat to our democracy right now. Free speech is fine. Debate is fine. These are all important parts of our democracy. But when it descends into vicious mudslinging, these conspiracy theories, it's really problematic. And quite frankly, I'm really quite concerned that the path out of this infodemic, as some people are calling it, is complex. I'm not sure that we can get out of it anytime soon because of the breadth of the problem. And really, again, what's at threat really is our democracy right now. And so we need to start taking measures to try and clean up that information space and making sure that Canadians are a little bit more aware of the information that they're consuming.
Are we that gullible, though, that we're falling for a lot of this stuff? We look at the example of a rather famous Canadian, Jamie Sallet, a former Olympic champion skater, who I guess is active on Twitter. And there's a number of situations here with tweets about Justin Trudeau, claiming to be from Justin Trudeau, with very misleading information on this. And people eat this stuff up. You look at the number of people that tapped into that and that follow that. It's remarkable, and it's frightening.
Right. There are some very clever people out there who are aware of the biases that exist. Certainly during COVID, emotions are running high. A lot of these, we'll call them extremist platforms, some on the far right, some on the far left, but a lot of them certainly on the far right, were promoting various different conspiracies, anti-government, anti-authority narratives, claiming that, all sorts of things about COVID vaccines and the pandemic itself. A lot of that, of course, was directed towards the government. And it's understandable that people in Canada and around the Western world were frustrated. But I think that some of these platforms, some of them, we can't call them news websites. These are just simply online platforms that, recognized the opportunity to exploit those fears and have just been pushing all sorts of conspiracy theories and rabid partisanship. And a lot of that has been directed at Justin Trudeau. Now, has the federal government, has any level of government been perfect in its response to COVID and such? Absolutely not. And I think that all of those levels of government will recognize their failures. But to attack them, you know, again, with some of these conspiracy theories, you know, this F. Trudeau movement that's out there is really, again, you know, I think inside of a democracy, we should have rational debate based on facts. This sort of Trudeau must go, F. Trudeau, you know, we have elections in this country. And certainly, you know, we should have that debate. We should make, you know, if there, those individuals want to make a change during that election, that's the time to do it. But the way that, you know, some of this, the rhetoric that's been flying around on social media and such is unbecoming of I think our democracy and quite frankly is quite dangerous. And you mentioned the fact that, you know, images have been made up. I just recently saw we analyzed a picture that was posted online and tweeted quite widely amongst some far-right organizations of Chrystia Freeland, or targeting rather Chrystia Freeland. It was a picture of Adolf Hitler with the family of Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propagandist. Joseph Goebbels' wife was in there, and the picture claimed that Joseph Goebbels' wife was actually Chrystia Freeland's grandmother. And this was tweeted thousands of times, retweeted several thousand times, and exposed to hundreds of thousands of viewers. And, you know, I think that most people who are predisposed to these sorts of conspiracies and narratives and who have been, you know, emotionally riled up by some of this stuff, you know, they simply believe this, that you know, Chrystia Freeland's grandmother was a Nazi who visited with Hitler. And what that's supposed to do is erode trust in our government. And it's doing that. The fact that you see these narratives, again, that F. Trudeau movement, the Trudeau's Gotta Go movement, it's becoming far more vicious than it has in years. And I'm quite concerned about how all of this will eventually manifest itself. We saw what happened in Ottawa. You know, we could see much worse in the coming months or years.
Well, again, you know, and the people that pass these things on, I don't know if all of them believe it. Maybe some of them don't believe it, but they all look at, they hate that individual, and I'm going to throw that out there because somebody is going to, you know, take this in and they're going to absorb it. And that's, it festers the hatred, really. And I think that's what's scary. And we saw January 6th, of course, in the States a couple of years ago, what can happen. That's a worst case scenario. But we've seen it happen or almost happen too many times. And let's face it, some of these incorrect disinformation tweets or posting or whatever it is going to be are contributors to that.
No, you're absolutely right. Look, in our country, in the Western democratic world, we are entitled to have opinions, and defending that right, the individual's right to say what they wish, is critically important in order for our democracy to function. Is it ugly sometimes? Absolutely. Democracy can be messy. The problem, however, arises when we're expressing these sorts of opinions, not based on facts, but on conspiracies and lies and misinformation and disinformation. That's where we run into problems. And so, you know, the fact that, you know, you brought up this former Olympic champion, people with those sorts of profiles who have followers really need to take a look at what they're doing and why they're doing these things. The sort of partisanship that they're promoting. They have a responsibility to check what they're putting out there on social media to make sure that it's based on actual facts and that they're not inadvertently or intentionally tweeting misinformation and disinformation. And I'll be honest with you, it's hard to think about how we might be able to do this. This isn't something that, you know, I think the government can legislate or regulate necessarily. It's going to take really a whole of society approach to reflect on how we are engaging with each other, and making a concerted effort to clean that up, and certainly making sure that, you know, future generations don't continue down this ugly road, and making sure that they have the proper skills, the media literacy skills, to understand the difference between opinions and facts. and to recognize misinformation and disinformation and reject it when they do see it. That's the only way out of this. It's a fix there's no silver bullet to this, but this is something that we need to look at in the long term for the health of our entire nation.
Absolutely. Listen, I got a couple of minutes left here, Marcus, and I want to pivot if I could, because I know you've been following the war in Ukraine very, very closely and Putin's reaction. It was a bad week militarily, bad couple of weeks, I guess, for the Russians. Earlier this week, of course, he says he's going to mobilize hundreds of thousands of reservists. I'm sure you saw the pictures on the news last night. There's a mass exodus in just about every city, especially in Moscow, of these potential reservists getting out of town. They don't want to be part of this anymore. Which I think in and of itself tells a story, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, right now what we're seeing in Russia is panic. The government is panicking. Vladimir Putin is panicking. He recognizes that his own authority may be threatened in the coming weeks and months because, this war has simply just gone that badly for him. Let's not forget that at the beginning of the war, he stated very publicly that this was a three-day special operation that Russia was engaging in. We're in month number 7. There are tens of thousands of young Russian men who have been killed on the front. This information is now starting to leak out into the Russian public. The fact that he's now calling up 300,000 troops, mobilizing 300,000 young Russians and older Russians as well, is clearly a sign to Russians that things are not going well. They are not interested in this war in Ukraine. And you're right, they are leaving. There's a mass exodus out of the country right now. There are reports that there are lineups on land borders, 30 to 40 kilometers long, of these young Russian men that are leaving. And criticism, public criticism, has also been rising. You mentioned the fact that there are some protesters that have been out on the streets. Also, some celebrities in Russia are calling for an end to this war. So the things are not looking good for Russia, and we need to keep an eye out for what he might do next to retaliate against and to make up for what he perceives to be his losses.
I run on one-way tickets out of the country, flights to Turkey, Georgia, Armenia, other countries, especially those three, because they don't require visas from the Russians. Those were all sold out within minutes. So there's and I know that Putin mentioned even yesterday in his speech about bringing these people up that he still has the support of the Russian people. I think we should question statements like that.
Well, those Russians that aren't going out on the streets. Sure. I mean, you can't say that they're supporting the war. They're just not criticizing it because they fear getting arrested. I don't think that there's widespread support for this this war right now. One of the more interesting facts that came out last week was that Yevgeny Prigozhin, who is known as Putin's chef, this is a guy that runs a private military contractor called Wagner, which is being cited by the UN as having been involved in several mass atrocities in Africa. This guy Prigozhin went into a Russian jail to try and mobilize and convince murderers and rapists to join the cause and fight the Ukrainians. He's apparently managed to sign up 3,000 of them at this point. And one report last week's claimed that even a cannibal, a man-eating cannibal, someone who had been arrested for murdering and eating his victims, had signed up for Putin's war in order to be granted a release after when the war was over. So this is how desperate this guy is, and it wouldn't surprise me in the least if there were these protests that we're seeing now that they grow over the coming days and weeks. And I would argue that this could be what we're seeing right now. Could be the start of the end of Vladimir Putin. I think that this will spark a grassroots uprising. I think that people will rise up, demand a change in leadership, and I think that we in the West need to do all that we can to help that process along.
Marcus, as always, thank you so much for this great conversation today. I always appreciate it. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again soon.
Anytime. Thanks for having me on, Bill.
You betcha. Marcus Kolga, director of disinfowatch.org, and of course a senior fellow at the McDonald Laurier Institute.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
It's been a bad week for Donald Trump in the courts, notwithstanding the fact that he thought he was going to get his way on a couple of different issues. Yesterday, kind of a bombshell from New York State. Didn't really see that one coming anytime soon. New York's attorney general has announced a massive lawsuit against members of the Trump family, including the former president, linked to allegations of asset valuation fraud. Global's Reggie Cicchini has details.
After a multi-year investigation into the finances of the Trump Organization, New York Attorney General Letitia James on Wednesday announced a $250 million lawsuit that, among other things, seeks to ban the company from New York, alleging business fraud that inflated his net worth by billions of dollars.
Mr. Trump and the Trump Organization repeatedly and persistently manipulated the value of assets to induce banks to lend money to the Trump Organization on more favorable terms than would otherwise have been available to the company.
Trump and three of his children aren't named in the suit, and while this is a civil case, the attorney general says she believes there to be elements of federal violations and has made criminal referrals to both the Southern District of New York and the IRS. Reggie Cicchini, Global News, Washington.
Well, and there's some updates on what's going on, too, with the Mar-a-Lago raid as well, that Trump, I'm sure, is not going to be pleased with. To try to dissect all of this stuff, pleased to welcome back to the program Brian J. Karam. Brian, of course, is a political analyst for CNN, White House reporter, a columnist with Salon.com and The Washington Diplomat, host of Just Ask the Question, a great podcast to find out what's going on in American politics, and author of the new book, Free the Press, The Death of American Journalism and How to Revive It. Brian, welcome back. Good to have you on again.
Good to be here. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. We're being inundated here with bad news about Donald Trump in court.
Well, he's inundated with bad news.
Well, did you see this one coming? Because I think the last time you and I talked, there was some concern that the Southern District of New York had, I don't know if they'd given up, but they just weren't doing much about the investigation there. And then, boom! All of a sudden, we get this word from the New York's Attorney General. This is civil. It's different than a trial, than a criminal court, but just as damning, really.
Well, yeah, it's very damning. It stems from the Michael Cohen investigation. Michael Cohen, when he was went to prison, gave up all this information and told everyone exactly what was going on with the Trump Organization. There is no difference between the Trump Organization and Donald Trump. He's the organization. And it was disappointing for many that nothing was done criminally, but the attorney general of the state of New York said, just a second, we'll take care of this. And so filed a $250 million lawsuit against Donald Trump and, went through chapter and verse in that press conference yesterday, citing very specific ways in which Donald Trump defrauded banks, the IRS, and the American people. I think it is the opening gong in the aria that will mean the end of Donald Trump. I do believe that he's going to be indicted for criminal activity. And I do believe this lawsuit will really rip him apart. I don't think there's any way he recovers from it. But, Donald Trump has defied the odds before because he's a slimy little guy. So we'll see if he slimes his way out of this one. But I don't think he can.
I mean, some of the numbers that she was throwing around yesterday were just outstanding, just ridiculous. The price of his apartment, the size of his apartment.
Yeah. he claimed it was like a 34,000 square feet. It was only 11,000. He claimed Mar-a-Lago was worth $750 million. It was only worth $75 million. I mean, he inflated everything.
Brian, you've been reporting for a long time and trying to, lift up rocks and find out what's really going on. He put this information forward and he won. He got what he wanted. Do these organizations like Deutsche Bank and others that he was dealing with, do they not do their own research on this stuff?
Well, apparently not. Or either they didn't turn the other cheek or they didn't and got taken advantage of that way. Either way, Deutsche Bank is now cooperating with the AG. So that tells you that maybe they were either embarrassed or culpable. But yeah, they should have. If it had been you or me, they would have. I couldn't get away with that.
You know that. I mean, they're after you like white on rice if you just miss by a couple of bucks.
Yeah.
But I think she mentioned yesterday in one of her offhanded comments during the Q&A after her statement this is the Attorney General, Letitia James, that that no condo or apartment in New York City is worth the kind of money that Donald Trump says his is. I don't care how big you think it is or how much you think it's worth. It just, it's outlandish. And as you say, you have to wonder about complicity now with some of these other organizations. And are they going to be under the gun now?
Yeah, and you kind of have to wonder about the complicity of the IRS and the guy that he appointed to head the IRS. There's a lot of people that'll be shaking in their shoes this morning after that press conference yesterday. But it wasn't even just that press conference, which is funny. I mean, last night, you know, it dropped. First of all, it dropped that the Justice Department can continue their investigation into Donald Trump, and then he goes on Hannity last night on Fox and claims that, you know, he said the secret word and declassified everything, or he thought it, or mental telepathy. And that's just, he's just so many ways he's walked himself into his own corner, and he's going to, you know, as the saying is, hoisted by his own petard. That's, a lot of this is coming home to Donald Trump now, and the next few months are not going to be real good for the Trump organization, Donald Trump or his children. We're just down here. We're just betting on which child he throws under the bus first.
Yeah, that's, you know, when the water level starts going, you have to wonder who's going to get tossed over. But to that point, and you know what, we're talking about the Supreme Court starts to work again, Colbert, their next session starts and everybody's getting back to work. And remember, you and I have talked about this, and you've written about the politicalization of the Supreme Court, especially with the Roe versus Wade decision. And Chief Justice John Roberts, you know, was insistent that, you know, politics has nothing to do with their decision. You know, there are no Republicans or Democrats, they're just judges. Why is it then,
and if you believe that, I got a bridge I'll sell you real cheap.
Exactly. Why is it then that every time a court rules on something, they always have to say whether it's a Democratic or Republican judge?
Good question. I find both parties loathsome in the extreme. One is the party of no heart and one is the party of no head. But at least the Democrats have an idea of what democracy is supposed to be. So I'll give them that. But yeah, it's frightening and it's frustrating that whenever a decision is made in the United States in a court of law, we have to, you know, tell you whether the judge is a Democrat or Republican. And actually, I like in some places in the U.S., you cannot run as a Democrat or Republican. They're nonpartisan and you have to run, you know, without the label. And still they'll affix a label to you afterwards. Well, you used to be in the Democratic Party. Well, you're a well-known Democratic operative. Well, you're a Republican. You know, that's even though they're not. So the problem with justice in the United States is when it's tainted by party instead of justice.
Well, it is. And that's the thing I find frustrating through this whole thing, because it's almost as if there's an insinuation that political leaning is going to have an influence on the judge's ruling on situations like this. And there was certainly a lot of backlash about, you know, Justice O'Connor, I guess, who initially said that the Justice Department couldn't touch these documents. And she did that twice, of course. And this was a three-judge panel of the 11th Circuit Court. Two of them were Trump judges. Mm-hmm. The other one was not. So maybe justice is blind, Brian.
Well, you know, when people worry about those things being kicked upstairs to the Circuit Court of Appeals, the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, and they say they were justices that were appointed by Trump, I'll remind everyone that in my own lawsuit against Donald Trump to keep my press pass, he lost. I beat him in court three times, and the panel that reviewed it on appeal at one point in time, what consisted of two Donald Trump appointees. Just because you're a Trump appointee doesn't look. Donald Trump didn't look. They gave him some names and he checked it and he signed it. He didn't vet these people. These were vetted by, you know, a Republican. They were actually vetted by Mitch McConnell, Federal Society vetted them and gave them to Mitch. So, you know, Donald Trump doesn't know. He thinks if he signed him in the office that they owe him some kind of fealty. And judges are finicky that way. They think of themselves as God, so they're not gonna bow to the Donald Trump version. They think they're gods.
Well, and which is a nice segue, Brian, into the special master. The Trump team's suggestions actually got the gig. Judge Raymond Deary, retired judge, of course. And the word was, I'm sure you guys heard this in Washington too, that he seems like an anti-FBI judge. So that's exactly what we want, you know, because Donald Trump's an anti-FBI, just ask Jim Comey. But they had their first session this week, Brian, and he really raked the Trump people over the coals, didn't he?
Yeah, well, that's what, you know, Donald, they won't say how they declassified these classified documents. And I'll preface it by saying it really doesn't matter if they're classified or not classified. He can be charged based on the fact that he kept them. So that's one thing. But there are other secrets that you can't declassify. The nuclear secrets that he had cannot be declassified. And while a president has a wide range of powers to declassify them, there's a certain process through which they go. You can't just say, you know, I said the secret word, it's declassified. And the special, the master of disaster, the special master of disaster told Donald Trump he can't have his cake and eat it too. You can't say on the one hand, you know, it's declassified, but you didn't go through the process. You also can't claim that the FBI planted the evidence that was classified that you declassified that wasn't planted that you did plant. I mean, none of it makes any sense. And Judge Deary, you know, chewed into him pretty good about that. It doesn't bode well for Donald. If you follow it logically, if Donald Trump can just, you know, wish it into declassification, then Biden, when he becomes president, can wish it back into classification. You know, and yeah. Trump can't then say, well, that only works for me. You know, that there's no logic. There's no logic to his argument at all. And I think, you know, any judge cogent enough to sit on a bench, and Deary has a lot of experience. A lot of the problems with a lot of the federal judges appointed by Donald Trump is that they're very young and don't have the gravitas to be there. It's not that they're tilted toward the right or tilted to the left. It's just that they're ignorant. But this man is not. And he was appointed by Ronald Reagan, another loathsome creature. But nonetheless, Judge Deary does have some gravitas, does have some experience. And one thing that judges acquire on the bench after many years there is a very good radar on detecting BS when they smell it. And that's what Donald Trump is full of. And the judge called him on it.
Well, and it was fascinating to see, too, because of the way he was treated. And what happened the other day in court, you've told me this happens time and time again when Trump goes to court. His lawyers spin some fantastical stories. You know, Trump went on Hannity last night and did the exact same thing. But what I really liked what the judge Deary basically said, because the lawyers were going on about all this stuff about, you know, this is all unnecessary and these are declassified. And he says, would you testify to that under oath? And of course, as you said, every time you ask, the lawyers back off because they said, no, I'm not going to lie under oath. Absolutely not.
Right. I'll lie as long as it's not under oath. I'll tell you a BS story. But if I got to sit down and raise my hand, I'm not doing it.
That tells you all you need to know about these guys. I mean, Trump is going to continue to do this as well. Where does this put him right now? And by the way, we should just remind our listeners, the New York lawsuit is actually naming the Trump adult children too. They're all implicated in this whole situation. So this is a big net that they're throwing.
Yeah, and like I said, it'll be a short, you know, march before Donald Trump throws one of his own children under the bus, because Donald Trump is nothing if not all about himself. So that'll be interesting to see how long it takes for him to where it goes. But this is the opening salvo. The suit filed by the attorney general, the civil suit filed by the attorney general, is just the first step. Yeah, I firmly believe from my sources in the government that this is a well-coordinated effort. Merrick Garland is sitting at the top. He knows everything that's going on. He's a very methodical, meticulous man who doesn't care about politics, who cares about the rule of law. He's coming for Donald Trump, and I would not want to be in his crosshairs. I don't think people fully understand how determined and how methodical and how meticulous Merrick Garland is. And there's no way that suit in New York was filed that the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. did not know what was going on. They are pulling the strings.
You know, it's interesting. I think somebody drew the analogy of way back when. You'd remember this, Bobby Kennedy going after Jimmy Hoffa when he was the attorney general. But Kennedy made it personal. Merrick Garland is using the long arm of the law here. That seems to be his tool.
Oh, yeah. It's not personal. It's all business. It's strictly business. As they say, Donald Trump messed with the wrong mob. He messed with the Department of Justice, and they are pretty meticulous.
So where does this go? I mean, we know the civil suit's going to take a long time. Apparently, just they characteristically take a long time to go through the courts. There won't be any jail time associated if, in fact, they find him to be culpable in this situation. He'll probably have to pay substantial money. And like you say, they don't want him doing business in New York or a couple of other cities for that matter, too. But what about this idea about, you know, some of this information going to the Southern District and to the Department of Justice? There's a possibility, I get from that, Brian, that there could be further charges based on their investigation.
Of course. But, you know, the problem in New York is, you know, you've got someone sitting there that the guy who should have filed the civil criminal charges has not done so, Bragg. So you have to wonder, where is he? You know, he tweeted out yesterday, this investigation is ongoing. Well, great. It's ongoing. Where is it going? When is it going to get there? And what more do you need? If the attorney general can file a civil suit and has all the information needed to do it, and the very same information provided for the civil suit could be used in a criminal action, I would like to see that criminal action filed sooner rather than later. That's the one stumbling block in this whole thing. But I think in the end, he will be charged in New York. I believe he's going to be charged federally, and he faces charges in Georgia as well as Giuliani, as well as Meadows, as well as the children. As you know, there's a whole host of people in the Trump inner circle that are going to go into a very strange place in their life after the first of the year.
And, of course, the January 6th committee in Congress gets underway again. Now, I know they've got a very limited time frame because they're only going to be there a couple of weeks, and then everybody shifts into election mode. And Liz Cheney, of course, won't be there after that.
She won't be there after January, so they've got until the end of the year to finish up.
Yeah, exactly. Any opportunities here, do you see, for them to get some conclusions to this and some finality?
Yeah, I think this has been a well-choreographed effort from the very beginning. Jamie Raskin, one of the members of that committee, has put it in very stark terms as to what's going on and how it needs to proceed. Liz Cheney has her own timetable, and I think this is the best effort that the traditional Republicans and traditional Democrats have of working together to achieve a goal for the good of the United States. I think that they have so far done a very good job that has highlighted where Merrick Garland is going. And I can guarantee you again that Merrick Garland's people are involved in the January 6th hearing. That they are being briefed. They know what's going on. They are using some of the same witnesses. I think at the end of the day, the January 6th committee will tie a nice bow on it. And I think there are going to be more. I think there are going to be a few surprises on September 28th at the next hearing. And I think at the end of the day, there are going to be a few more people involved that most people thought but didn't really know. And they're going to be surprised by what happens.
Podcast you want to go to is called Just Ask the Question. Brian hosts that, and it gives you great insight into what's going on the American political scene. Brian, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for this today.
Always, anytime.
You betcha. Brian J. Karam, of course, political analyst, author, and podcaster.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
We want to talk about food insecurity. Now, that's a phrase that probably wasn't in our vocabulary a number of years ago because we just weren't paying attention. This is Canada, right? This is one of the most affluent countries in the world. Well, a new report suggests that almost 3 out of 4 Canadians have made significant changes to how they grocery shop due to these higher prices. Global's Janet Brown has details.
A study by Dalhousie University's Agri-Food Analytics Lab and consumer data collector Cattle is showing many shoppers have gone out of their way to save money on food in the face of record inflation. Nearly 24% of respondents said they were cutting back on their food purchases because of rising costs. 8% said they have changed their diet, and 7% said they are skipping meals or snacks altogether. Almost a third said they have been watching weekly store flyers more often, and nearly a quarter have made more use of coupons. The survey reached 5,000 people across the country between September 8th and 10th. Janet Brown, Global News.
It's getting worse, and that therein lies the problem. There was an op-ed piece in the Toronto Star the other day that I think highlights exactly some of the concerns and, some of the government inaction on this I think we need to talk about as well. The author is Armin Yalzazan, who, of course, is an economist and Atkinson Fellow on the future of workers. And she joins us again on the Bill Kelly Show to give us some details about what's going on. Armin, thank you so much for this. I really appreciate the time today.
It's always a pleasure, Bill.
I just mentioned, the idea about food insecurity is something that was, I think, foreign to a lot of us. We might go to the No Frills as opposed to one of the bigger shopping markets. Might try to save a few pennies on a tune of canna, but well, there's always going to be food, and we'll always have enough money for food. That's not the case anymore.
No, in fact, a StatCan study showed that 6 million people had some form of insecurity in 2021, and that was better almost everywhere in Canada than in 2020, because people were getting some kind of emergency relief from the government because of the pandemic. Fascinatingly, Ontario was the only place that bucked that trend. There were more people hungry in 2021 than 2020. And we know now, with food inflation being the fastest growing and most unrelenting growth in inflation for the last few months, we know more people are going to be hungry.
Well, and it's varying. I know that. I mean, there are some people that are just going to whine and complain about, how much I'm paying for bread and for hamburger these days. But there's a whole other group of people that just say, well, I can't buy anything now. I don't have enough money to feed myself. That's a crisis situation. We should mention, by the way, when we throw a phrase around like food insecurity, there's variations on that theme, of course. That can be people, as you mentioned, that maybe have had to make some changes in their diets or maybe not eat as often. But there are some people that just aren't able to buy groceries these days.
Yeah, that's actually a really important thing to define what we mean by food insecurity. There's about three categories. Some are worried about running out of food. It's not like they've already done their budgeting and they're running out of food, or they can't buy certain things for lack of money. That is most frequently for things like buying meat. Can't buy meat or can't buy certain types of meat, but also sometimes fruit and veg. Then there's moderate food insecurity, which is you're compromising what you're buying, both in quantity and in quality, because you don't have enough money. And the third category of food insecurity, because you don't have enough money, is that you miss meals. You actually eat less. Sometimes you go for days without food. That's the category that we're worried about. Back in 2021, a quarter of a million households, not people, but households in Ontario, were in that third category, missing eating, actually choosing not to eat so that they could make ends meet. We know that number has increased now. And that's what we're on the lookout for right now. These surveys are only done very rarely. And we've that's your warning bell right there.
There's so many roads we can go down here to try to talk about what could be done here. And the one that jumps to mind as I was going over some of the data here last night, of course, was a basic income project, a living wage project. I mean, name it what you will. Doug Ford doesn't seem to have any interest in that, unfortunately. He killed that program within minutes of taking office a number of years ago. But things like that, when we talked about them at the time and people said, well, come on, is that really necessary? I'm not going to say, there's a lot of factors, inflation and the pandemic and everything else that were contributing factors to this, but these were vulnerable people then, and now they're past vulnerable. I mean, they're drastic, and they're in situations right now that I don't think anybody ever thought they'd find themselves in.
I think that's true, and what you're pointing to with the Basic Income Project, I personally don't have a lot of time for a bunch of reasons. One day we will talk about this, Bill. But what we need to talk about is the fact that people on low income, the people that are in this extreme category, are people living on disability pensions and welfare, are people living in extreme poverty in terms of the working poor, not enough hours, and the hours that they do work are paid too low, and seniors on fixed incomes that are just unable to keep up with other costs, and they are choosing to eat less. So those three categories all can be fixed without a basic income. You can target the money. One of the things that the federal government tried to do was to top up the federal housing benefit with another $500. Won't go very far, but it's something. They are doubling the GST credit for the next 6 months. Will come late, but it will, shovel a few hundred dollars. And if the federal government's money to the province for families with kids actually got spent, the Ontario government is still sitting on federal largesse to cut parent fees for childcare. We're still waiting for those checks to come in, even though they announced in April that fees would be cut by 25 cents, by 25%, and another 25% by the end of December. And like, the check's not in the mail. So there are so many things that could be done. That would be a relief of about an average $600 to $700 a month for families that pay for licensed childcare. So there's so many things that could be done to help put more cash in your pockets, not least of which would be raising the rates of social assistance, which were cut in 1995 by another conservative premier, Mike Harris, by 22%. And they have been nickeled and dime upwards at a time, you know, like ever since. It's like we just can't seem to make up for the extreme cruelty to do welfare cuts and tax cuts back in the mid-1990s. So yeah, there's plenty of things that we can be doing that we're not doing. We did a gas tax rebate. You get the money whether you need it or not, whether you take TTC or drive a car or not. You know, we've seen other things that literally threw money at people whether they needed it or not. So you could target funding and you can make it go to the people that we know are most likely to be going hungry. But we're not doing that either.
But governments are going to be wary, and you've heard all these economists. I've had a number of them on the program over the last couple of months, that said, governments start handing checks out. That's only going to fuel inflation. It's going to make a bad situation worse. So you're really hurting these people that are already in a dire circumstance. That's their conjecture anyway.
I cannot begin to tell you how infuriating I find this. These are the same people that said governments aren't doing enough about inflation. And when then the federal government did something about inflation, they said they're causing inflation. And their lips were zipped when Doug Ford and Jason Kenney introduced their gas tax, when Scott Moe, the premier of Saskatchewan, introduced his MoBucks, $500 for every adult, whether you need it or not. No comment about that inflationary impact, but so much ire for the idea that you would spend less than 0.1% of GDP to help those who are the most impoverished get through the next 6 months. That's going to be inflationary. I find it just, it gets stuck in my craw.
I know, but there's a willing audience that wants to buy into that and simply say, yeah, they're going to have to make it on their own. What was the phrase I think Mr. Polyev used here, that sending checks out is pouring gasoline on the inflation fire?
Oh,
that's a catchy line.
I just want to stop you right there, because I listened to the YouTube of that speech, which goes on for quite a while. It's like a 5-minute speech or a 4-minute speech. And at the 3.5-minute mark, he makes that comment about... first of all, he says all the things they're not doing. Then he points to what they are doing at the federal level and says it's like pouring gasoline on the fire. Literally 10 seconds after he says that, he says, and then there's the housing benefit, $500. In a city like Toronto, that would be $40 a month. That's not even a day's rent. So, you know, on the one hand, he's saying you're spending too much, you're triggering inflation, without any proof that that is the case. How can something that is 0.1% of GDP create inflation? It's just too small to create inflation. And the people that the money's going to are not even getting the money now. They're getting it in December. You're not stopping the Bank of Canada from taming inflation with this measure. But then you turn around and you say, oh, you're not spending enough money on a housing benefit. It's not big enough. Is it too much or is it too little? Pick a lane.
But, Armin, they did that long before Polyev was the leader, too. Remember, they voted against a number of government initiatives, and their rationale at the time was it's not enough. Well, so we're going to vote it down altogether. It boggles the imagination that it's because everything is infected here by politics. It's not what's going to be the best for the people in a situation like this. They're just playing politics with every one of these decisions.
You're absolutely right, Bill, that everything is becoming torqued up with politics, and it is obscuring the real and very avoidable story of human tragedy that is unfolding around us. And sadly, there's going to be way more to come, given where we think prices are headed. You know, of all the elements of inflation that were tamed, the headline number was a little bit lower increase than last month. It looks like the taming of the inflation monster may be imminent. The one element that isn't imminent is food. So food prices keep escalating in their increase. So the speed with which food prices are going up, you know, let me just give you some prices of basics. Sure. We're not talking about meat here, which went up by 6%. but something like pasta went up 32%. Something like cooking oil went up 28% year over year. Bread is up 15%. These are the basics, my friend. The yep. only thing that didn't shoot up like that is milk. And these are the same people that say the dairy marketing board is a problem. Milk only went up 8%. Yeah, it went up. But compare that to things that are not regulated at all, like pasta and bread. And that's those areas, those staples like bread and pasta and cooking oil. These are the things that are going to tip the scales come the fall. If we can't seem to increase the supply on the market and consequently lower the cost.
At the risk of sounding like Ebenezer Scrooge and are there no prisons, are there no workhouses? Some people are just going to say, well, they can go to a food bank. But my read on this, though, is look at if these things are costing as much as they are, and there's the prices you just rhymed off, food banks are going to be hard done by as well. They have to go and buy this stuff.
Right at the top of my article, actually.
And they're not rife with cash, the food banks. I mean, it's not as if they can just dip into their account in the Cayman Islands and say, we need more money here.
Year over year, I reported in my column that food bank usage tripled. They are now serving over 180,000 people a month, and the annual cost of purchasing food for those people has grown sixfold from last year. So $13 million a year to keep those shelves stocked, and charity is not growing because everybody's budget is being pinched. So we are heading for a fairly large-scale disaster.
I mean, that's a reality for people that have never been in a food bank. And I know they rely on donations, and there's some wonderfully generous people that do that sort of thing. But as you say, maybe you dropped off a couple of bags of groceries before. Now you're thinking, I can't afford it. That's all there is to it. I'm trying to put food on my own table right now. That's all I can afford to do. And I noticed that in my local grocery store. You know, go in there was a bin there that was always overflowing with, because they actually pre-make some of the bags, you know, $15, $20 worth of, it's empty the last couple of times. And it's simply, I don't think we've all become cold hearted. It's just, we can't afford to do it. Well, those shelves have to have something on them when those people go in there, and that's going to cost them a ton of money.
You just nailed it, my friend. Sadly, when we say that the market is fine, the market will deal with everything, governments are doing too much, these same people say charity will take care of the rest. And when markets go completely berserk, as they are doing right now for absolutely historically very unusual circumstances, charity isn't enough. We need to do something through the market. I mean, through governments.
We're going to need to keep talking about it, too. I mean, I just don't want to get caught up in political catchphrases like some people do in Ottawa and Toronto, for that matter, too, and start, you know, talking about the realities. And you certainly have done that with the piece that was in The Star. Armin, thank you so much for this. I really appreciate, first of all, writing the article, but spending some time with us today to try to explain this. Let's stay in touch as this evolves, hopefully for the better.
I agree, hopefully for the better. And thank you very much for having me on the airwaves with your people.
Thank you very much. Armin Jan-Olsen, of course, economist and Atkinson Fellow on the Future of Workers. And you can check that piece out in the Toronto Star webpage and get some of the details on that.
The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on 900 CHML.
The Bill Kelly Podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts from. You can also listen to The Bill Kelly Show weekdays from 9 till noon on 900 CHML. I'm Bill Kelly. Thanks again for listening. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. It's free, so you never miss an episode. And make sure that you rate and review.
I'm not just a pawn in this game.
Three nights a week on Global.
They're putting targets on their back. Massive.
Drama.
I guess you could say I'm in a showman.
They're just so in love and so annoying. Enough.
Betrayal.
The guy just put up his best friend now.
And plot twists.
What is happening right now?
You'll never see coming.
If you're coming for me,
this is perfect.
I'm coming for you then.
It'll be a battle.
Like, it'll be war.
Big Brother Canada. All new Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Sundays on Global. Stream on Stack TV.